On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It seems a situation that doesn't change much from administration to administration, from year to year. What's it like for children on the border trying to become legal immigrants or to be refugees? What's it like? Today, we're talking to Dr. Silvia Rodriguez-Vega, who's the author of Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children from New York University Press. You can check their website, nyupress.org. Dr. Silvia Rodriguez-Vega is the Assistant Professor of Chicana and Chicana Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She also has been researching the understudied pre-adolescent children of immigrants, both U.S.-born citizens and undocumented immigrant children. We're very interested in hearing what she has to say to us. Silvia, thank you so much for making time to talk to us today on the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
So, have you been to the border? Have you seen the children? How did you get some of these pictures that you have in your book?
Yeah, so most of the drawings come from either Arizona or California. The work started in 2008 when I was working with immigrant children at a community center in Phoenix, and then I also conducted a project in California. So I've studied and worked with children along the border, but not necessarily on the border specifically.
What got you interested in this? Is there a personal connection, or is it just a general concern for children who are caught in this very difficult situation?
I think it's a little bit of both. I and my family migrated to the United States when I was 3 years old. And so when I was working with young people, and we were making a mural, one of the kids said they wanted to make a mural about peace. And when I asked him, what does peace look like? He said, it looks like Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Arizona shaking hands with a Mexican. And that was such a vivid picture that this kid painted in my mind. But it really struck a chord personally because I also had seen how immigration policies were affecting children that I was working with, but also the community in general. So I think that's, you know, where the project initially was born and created from.
Now, you've done a lot of research on this, 10 years of work with immigrant children as young as 6 years old in Arizona, California. You've analyzed 300 drawings, theater performance, and family interviews. So you bring an awful lot of information to us that we haven't been getting in any of the media. And as well as this personal feeling about what it's like to be a literal new kid. When your family made the transition to the United States, if you're only three, you may not remember much, but do you sort of have some impressions or images of that time, or perhaps your parents talked about it later on?
Yeah, I mean, I have photographs from before I was three. In Mexico. And then at 3 years old, I turned three when we arrived to Phoenix. And so I knew from looking at these photographs and listening to my parents' stories that we weren't born here and that we were immigrants, but I didn't really understand what that actually meant because our visas expired. And so we were also undocumented. And it wasn't until high school and college that I started to really understand what that meant in terms of getting a driver's license, going to college and things like that. And specifically in Arizona during a time of anti-immigrant policies passing, then I really understood what it was like to live in a place that was anti-immigrant and that really was passing a lot of policy. So I had an intimate connection with it, with my own family, but also it was something that I was seeing all around me.
Now, there's an awful lot going on south of the border, so to speak, not just in Mexico, where there are drug cartels and so forth, but there are more than people just from Mexico who are coming to the United States. We have people from all over Central America and South America. What are some of the situations in these cities and in these countries that are making such an impact as far as numbers on the Mexican-American border?
Yeah, I mean, there are various factors. A lot of people who study immigration call this push and pull factors. So there are reasons why people are pushed out and then also pulled in specific directions. And so as far as some of the countries that you talked about, there's a long relationship with the U.S. For example, Mexico passed with the United States the North American Free Trade Agreement that basically opened the border for commerce, but not for people. And that meant that a lot of people had to move when their jobs situation shifted, and then it was an economic pull. If we think about Central America, there have been civil wars where the U.S. has intervened. And so this has created a lot of instability politically that has led to violence and various factors that also continue to push people. So it can range from things like war, violence, danger, but also natural disasters caused by climate change. So there are multiple reasons, many reasons why people migrate. And unfortunately, we're seeing many, many numbers of people not able to live in their countries of origin, not only these countries, but like Venezuela and other countries too.
Venezuela's economy has completely collapsed under socialism, and what had been a economically viable country decades ago, the money is worthless now. But there are other nations in South America that are having similar issues, right? There's turmoil in the country, and there's danger for children and parents alike. One of the things that we hear about a little bit, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about this, is the idea that parents concerned for their children are actually sending them on ahead of them in the hopes that if they can't get across, at least their children will survive. We saw this situation over the decades from Cuba. Do you feel like this is a major contributor, or is this just one more factor?
It definitely is one of the important considerations to think about. I think often the general public has this idea of, one, not being in that situation, so not knowing and understanding what can motivate someone not only to risk their lives to migrate to another place where they are unwanted and sometimes persecuted. But I think what we fail to think about is what conditions are created that risking your life or the life of your child to take on this journey, what condition is so terrible that people are running from? Like the odds of surviving, not migrating, are devastating. And so families resort to these difficult, impossible decisions often of a certain death if you remain where you live, or a possible death if you migrate. And so I think parents don't have choices when it comes to this. It's either inevitable suffering or possible suffering. And so these are some of the conditions where people are forced to send their children, or, you know, with the hopes that they would be accepted or make it to the United States, if not them too.
It just reminded me of Operation Pedro Pan in the early part of the ongoing interesting relationship the United States and Cuba have had since Castro came to power in 1959. People sent their kids to theoretically stay with relatives in the United States temporarily, but what they were really doing was trying to get them out of Cuba and to a place of safety and having to do that very thing. So when I read about it in your book, that came to my mind. I grew up in Florida, and I have a lot of friends in Cuba even today. And so that's kind of my way of looking at what it's like to be an immigrant too. Should we draw some lines here as far as, or maybe I should say, let's define some terms, that there is a difference between being a refugee and being an immigrant. There's a difference between being an illegal immigrant and to be illegal. Is this mostly a matter of paperwork being filled out, or how if people feel that their homeland is unsafe and they want to come to the United States to be safe, that's a different sort of motivation than they'd like more economic opportunities in the United States. How is that handled? Is that a paperwork issue? Do they have to go to, is that one of the things that run into at the border of trying to explain, hoping to save my children from what's going on?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I feel like it's important to distinguish these categories because immigrants are not a monolith and they have various statuses, like you mentioned, seeking refuge, refugee status, seeking asylum, their temporary protected status, there is permanent residency, there's citizenship. There's also folks who have none of this and are undocumented. And so all of these things depend on so many variables, like when you came, how you came, how long you've been here. What is very clear is that there isn't a clear path for citizenship for many people. Even if you've lived here for very long or if you just arrived, when it comes to the last administration, the asylum process was decimated. And what we may not know is that seeking asylum is a human right. And so people have the right to enter the United States to ask for asylum. And what we saw during Trump was a blockage of that. People were not allowed to come in and ask for asylum. And one of the things that I want to say that connects to your reflection about Florida and the Pedro Pan historical example is that it depends on where people are coming from and who they are, if they're wanted in the U.S. or not. Because we have children who are Central American who literally were detained, taken away from their families, put in these tiny cells and cages when they were unwanted. But then we had an amazing feat that the United States accomplished when children who were of elite members of Cuban society were sent. They were taken care of. They were given resources. They were reunited with family members. And even if we think of the child that also, you know, was pushed and pulled between Cuba and the United States in the 90s, it was because of the U.S. interest with Cuba. And I think that all immigrants aren't considered equal when you think about class, race, and many things like that.
Well, certainly people from Cuba come in all colors, that's for sure. I don't know about the class issue, but there is a difference between a refugee and an immigrant. And what makes a person an immigrant, it depends on the motivation, like you said. Immigrants are not monolithic. And certainly the situation on the border is not something that just turned sour during one administration. It was, even though we get promises from one politician or another, the current administration and the two that preceded it and the ones that preceded that all have had problems with the Mexican border. So what makes it interesting to me is that, and this is, of course, what you're talking about in the book, is that how children respond to this, their take on what it's like to be in their situation as expressed in their drawing. Was this something that you, as a researcher, encouraged them to do, or was this something they were already doing and you found out about it and then asked them about it? Tell me how that the knowledge of that developed for you.
Yeah, so initially I wasn't doing a research project. Like I mentioned, I was working in a community center. We were creating a mural. The mural did not get approved, and so kids were really upset that they had finally a moment to express a worry that they had in the community, and then that expression was stopped. So I asked kids, why was this mural important to you? Why did you want to do this? You can do a drawing, a poem, a letter. And that's when I started to collect these drawings. So initially it was about a reflection on making a mural about immigration. When I actually collected the drawings, it was much deeper. It was about the fears, the experiences, the possibilities that they saw to make things better. And then later on, this actually became a research project where I included interviews, observations, all sorts of methods to be able to understand how immigration policies impact children. I collected surveys and taught a class for 2 years for children who were in sixth grade. And so all of this resulted in hours of interviews and classroom recordings and theater performances and, of course, the drawings that are in the book. So it was a collection of various methods that I later analyzed and put together to write the book.
We're talking, in case you're joining us late, to Silvia Rodriguez-Vega, who is assistant professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in the Department of Chicano Studies. Her research highlights the understudied pre-adolescent children of immigrants, both U.S.-born citizens and undocumented immigrant children. She is also concerned with a lot of different issues, and we're having a chance to talk to her about them today. Her new book is Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children. It's from New York University Press. You can check their website, nyupress.org. What were the biggest surprises that you found in the performances? To me, I would not be surprised at all. I was not surprised at all at them putting a public face on what was distressing them or being upset about them or blaming the president for the situation they're in. That's normal for children. Children, pre-adolescents particularly, they have a certain intuition, but they also believe what they're told, and they also can see what's going on around them. Were there things about the artwork that surprised you?
Yeah, I mean, to me and to many people, it was surprising that they were paying attention this closely. It wasn't hard because during this time, it was during the election, so if you turn on the news or the radio or grab a newspaper, it was always about the election and what each candidate was proposing and talking about. So they were student in all of this, but what was surprising is what they did with that information. They were able to have really sophisticated critiques about war, about foreign relations, and that was really interesting. But I think what surprised me personally was that I expected them to express these worries and stresses, but I didn't really expect it to be a fun process. I didn't expect humor to come from it. And in giving kids an opportunity to be creative, you find how they turn a situation that is terrible into a moment of possibility, into something hilarious and funny. And I think I didn't appreciate that until I was working with them and was taking a deep look at what they were coming up with in theater skits and things like that. So that was a big surprise.
I don't want to really talk politics a lot, but I was curious about this. This is one of the provided questions, and Peter and I have been working together for a long time. So when he sends a question about this, I think maybe I should ask about it. And his question was, while the Obama administration employed a narrative claiming that only the immigrants who were the worst criminals would be deported, its deportation record rivaled Trump's. What precedent did the Obama years quietly establish?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I'm glad it's included, because we often think that Trump was terrible to immigrants, and that was clear to see because it was very vocal targeting of people seeking asylum and immigrants in general who were already in the country. But what folks don't know is that what Trump did was based on the plan that the Obama administration already was executing. There were already people who were detained. There were already families that were separated. And the Obama administration created this blueprint of mass deportation. So the administration was enforcement-focused rather than service-oriented. And one of the ways that this happened was through something called the 287G agreements that happened during the Obama times, which meant that local law enforcement, like police officers, highway patrol, had a relationship and resources that connected them to ICE, which stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, at a national, federal level. So anytime in the local level, a person who was undocumented had any interaction with the law, be it a victim of a crime or jaywalking or anything, that interaction led to immigrant detention, which was also a for-profit system that you could buy stock. And we also had the militarization of the border. So all in all, the Obama administration, yes, passed deferred action for childhood arrivals, which created a temporary protected status for undocumented young people, but at the same time focused on detaining the quote-unquote worst criminals. But what really happened was anybody who had any interaction with the law also was detained and deported.
I think that's a really important point to make. And I would also think that in the eyes of children, if the only people that they see wearing uniforms are people that are trying to keep them from doing what they feel like they need to do or like their parents say we need to do, they're not going to see them as trying to protect them. They're going to see them as problems. And there are certainly places in South America where there is corruption among the police. It seems to me like that would be difficult for even kindest ICE agents and Border Patrol officers to overcome the fact that children are coming from places where they inherently don't trust any of the police anyway. And then if these people are stopping them from coming in, they're going to feel, well, this is nothing new. We kind of have come to expect this. And I realize your book is about helping children to deal with the stress, to deal with the situation, to express themselves. And I'm not trying to turn this strictly into a political discussion, but is there something that can be done to help these kids out? I mean, if you've been down there on the border and you've talked to all these children, what do you think would be something that would be reasonable that would help to break the deadlock at the border? Is it having more agents? Is it having more counselors? Are there enough of the people that are bilingual? Is that an issue? What would you suggest?
Yeah, that's a huge question. I think I've been thinking about this for almost two decades and thinking about it in different ways. For example, yes, we need resources in schools that are, for example, for counseling services, psychological services. And I even go and express that we need art for children to be able to just process some of the things that they go through, and not even related to immigration, but all of the things that we encounter in society that aren't easy. But when it comes to changing things for children who are part of the society and are U.S. citizens, because one of the things that I'd like to mention is that there are 5.5 million children in the U.S. who have one undocumented parent at least. But of that number, the majority of the kids, 4.5 million, are children who are U.S. citizens. And that means that they're already part of our society and are going to be in the future. And so for the sake of these children, I think we need systemic change that does include a path towards citizenship. But it's hard to think about something quote-unquote reasonable when immigration laws and enforcement has been unreasonable for the last couple of decades. We see so many dying on the border. We see children that have died on the border or in the rivers. And we see the suffering that has happened in the U.S. with the detention process. And so I think that uniting families is the very first step to mitigate the damage that has been caused by these policies.
I know our time is getting close and we've covered some pretty important ground here. Is there anything else that you wanted to tell us more about? Because obviously we're at a disadvantage in an audio program to talk about visual art. Is there anything about your book and the research that you did that led to the book and the children that you met that you wanted me to ask you about and I have not done so?
I appreciate the moment to think about this, because I do want to bring something up. I think that what happened on the border with the separation of children and families was so appalling to the majority of people. And one thing that I want us to think about is that this is not the first time that children have been separated from their families. And if we think about Ukrainian refugees and families, how our policies are so open and we genuinely are trying to accommodate this population while at the same time excluding migrants and refugees from Haiti and other countries. I think that this is a deeply historical problem in the U.S. if we think about the Japanese internment camps or the Native American schools where kids were taken from their families and communities to be Americanized, or just, you know, if we go to the enslavement and sale of Black children and the separation of their families, this is a very old problem that if we don't think about these things as being connected, we're going to repeat this cycle. And I think none of us want this suffering to continue in the future.
I would point out that there were German and Italians on the East Coast that were interned during World War II as well. So I'm not exactly sure if the Japanese internment during World War II is really the same kind of situation as we're seeing on the border. What can we do? Do we try to get a hold of our representatives and senators in Congress? There's so many layers between us and them because of the enormous staffs they have. What is the thing that has the best chance of success that the average American citizen can do?
Yeah, we often feel so powerless when we think about how change is made in the country. But I would just challenge us to be very simple about this and just care. I think just taking a moment to listen to this, to see the drawings that children created, to listen to the interviews, and just to really take a moment to actually care and listen is something that I think can be transformative, because often it seems like such a difficult subject and that we can't create change, that we accept it and we kind of become desensitized to it. And I think that challenging ourselves to not accept this as normal is one of the first places to start. And then I think all of the things that we can do, voting, calling people, writing letters, creating opportunities to talk about this with our neighbors and friends is a great place to start.
Silvia Rodriguez Vega, the author of Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children from New York University Press. Check the website, nyupress.org. Sylvia, do you have a website also?
I do. People can visit Sylvia, S-I-L-V-I-A, RodriguezVega.com, and NYU Press.
Very good. Thank you very much for making time to talk to me and for bringing a new perspective to people. In South Alabama, we don't have borders that we have to worry about here. So for us, it often can become academic if we're not careful. But there are an awful lot of Hispanic people that have come to work in Alabama. So we see them now and we get to know them. We like them. We're glad they're here. And therefore, it behooves us to be a little more aware of what's going on further west of us, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave.
Absolutely. Once again, we've been talking to Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez Vega, assistant professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, in the Department of Chicano Studies. She is the author of Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children from New York University Press. You can check her website, SylviaRodriguezVega.com or NYUPress.org. Thanks so much for joining us, and get into a dialogue this week with people, especially if you don't know if you're going to agree with them or not. That's what dialogue is all about, isn't it? Have a good civil conversation and gain some fresh insight. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com and your favorite radio on the bookshelf right here on WTBF AM 970, FM 96.3, and FM 94.7. We'll see you next time. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.